something a little bit different this morning, you may have noticed. We read two readings that have to do with the exile of Israel from the Promised Land later on in the Old Testament. And so what I propose to do with you this morning is to just do a simple kind of chart or timeline that illustrates when that happened and what it meant, what it meant for them and what it means for us now. And I think it's helpful to remember that the Old Testament is trying to prepare the way for Jesus. That's the function of the Old Testament, to prepare the way for Jesus. And actually, by the end of this sort of teaching this morning, I hope that you will understand that the Old Testament's task partly is to prepare our hearts for Jesus. And as you know, we've been spending a little bit of time in the Old Testament this summer looking at the kings, Saul, David, and Solomon. We'll be looking at a few of the prophecies that take place in the later part of the Old Testament. And then in the fall, we'll be beginning Luke's Gospel. That's in about 4 or 5 weeks. So the exile, just to give you a date on the line and give you a bit of an orientation here, Christ enters creation at this time. This is around zero, the year zero. And I've gone back here, and I will tell you, I hope you can see most of this. This is a graph, okay? And in a graph, I've been told that you need to have an x-axis and a y-axis. And the y-axis, I'll explain in a minute. The x-axis, which is this, is years before Christ. And to give you an idea, Abraham is about 1,700 years before, and then we go all the way. So that just gives you an idea of the timeline that I'm working from here. The exile, the two scriptures that we read this morning, that's happening in this time frame, before and immediately after 587 B.C., Now, about 45% of the Old Testament is written around the time of the exile. And so it's a major part of the story in the Bible, but I think it's easy to leave it out. We don't read from it very often. And the readings that were read to us this morning were fairly depressing. And there's reasons for that. And here's why I think the exile is important. On Friday, I went with a family from our church to Lighthouse Park in West Vancouver, Point Atkinson. There's a lighthouse there, right at West Vancouver before Horseshoe Bay. And I found out when I was there that when the Crown set aside 75 hectares of forest back in a century ago, around the lighthouse. The reason they did that was so that the light from the lighthouse would shine against a dark background. So when the ships came into English Bay, they wouldn't confuse the lighthouse with the lights of the North Shore. So that's what that forest is, and I think that's, in some ways, what exile does. Exile is the dark background against which we can see the light of Christ. So you need to understand the darkness before you can appreciate the light. You need to understand the need before the gift. So, now I used to be a history teacher in high school, so I'm going to try and be a little bit of a history teacher for you right now. Here we have along the timeline, Abraham. We have the Exodus and then Moses in about the year 1300 before Christ. King David, about 1,000 years before Christ. And then I've got a few other things which I'll explain in a minute. And what I want to do is to set up for you three lines on this graph that will help us to understand the readings that we've read. Now, the first line is, or at least what we're trying to measure here, is the state, you may not be able to read this, it's the state of God's promises. Okay? So at the very beginning, we have creation. And as you know, there is a tragic and terrible fall and a rebellion of Adam and Eve and of humanity against the Lord who is king. And at the time of Abraham, God speaks to him in Genesis 12 and makes promises that effectively start to restore what was lost at the creation. And those promises I'm blanking on my word for a minute. It will come back to me. Those promises will be kept. They will be kept. They are unconditional. That's the word. They are unconditional. Abraham is asleep when God ratifies the covenant. Okay? So these are unconditional promises. They will be fulfilled. When we come to the Exodus in the time of Moses, a new covenant, a new set of promises is made through Moses to Israel. The difference is that Moses' covenant says, if you obey, the promises will continue, but if you disobey, there will be a curse instead of a blessing. That's the covenant with Moses. And then David. God comes and he speaks to King David and says, I promise you that you will have a descendant on the throne forever. And so those promises are unconditional. There's nothing David can do to make those promises get broken by God. So we know that God will keep the promises that he made to Abraham. We know that the promises to Moses have a blessing and a curse, and obedience is required. And we know that the promises to David are also unconditional. They will be kept. They will be kept. So that's the state of God's promises in the Old Testament. And now I want to draw out for you the second line, which is the state of God's kingdom in the Old Testament. Okay, and this is sort of the external reality of what God is doing in the Old Testament. So we know that God ruled over his creation, but that his people rebelled against him. And so we call that the fall. And the state of God's kingdom is not good at the fall. It all looks like it's falling. Everything God made has been trampled on. And then we have these promises that he makes to Abraham, which starts to restore and rebuild what was lost. And that, so it's looking a bit better. It's looking as if God is exercising his rule. And Abraham obeys and disobeys and kind of goes up and down. The promises, though, are kept, the promises for descendants, but they end up in Egypt in slavery. And even though the numbers of people are increasing, it looks like the promises aren't being kept. Because they're in slavery. They're in bondage. They're not free. They're not in God's land. Then we have this promise through Moses to Israel, the Ten Commandments. All of the Israelites are formed together as a nation under God, and he makes the covenant promises with him, with the nation. And as Moses is coming down the mountain with the Ten Commandments, do you remember what happened? As Moses Miriam? Yep, they build the calf. This is before they've even before Moses has come down, they build a golden calf and worship it. And there's a large dip in the reality of God's kingdom at that point. And then Moses intercedes. God is merciful. He leads the people towards the promised land. When they get to the promised land after 40 years in the wilderness, they have a series of judges, and their fortunes go up and down in the period of the judges. They obey God, then they disobey God, enemies attack, they cry out to God for mercy, God brings them a saving judge who helps them. And then finally they ask for a king, they get Saul, and then Saul proves to be disobedient, they get David, and under David, the kingdom is beginning to be established in a very firm way. And then they get Solomon, and Solomon builds the temple, and God's presence is situated in Jerusalem. They have rest from their enemies round about them, and it looks like the kingdom is in good shape. And then, as we saw from the last week, Solomon is divided. And he leads the people away from these promises to the point where, in about 930 before Christ, the kingdom is divided. The kingdom is split. And the kingdom at that point goes downhill. And in the year 722, the northern part of God's kingdom is taken into exile. And in the year 587, Judah, the southern part of the kingdom, is taken into exile. And that's where our readings have come from today. And in a sense, what's tragic about this is that the state of Israel here is actually, in many ways, worse than it was when they were in slavery in Egypt. Because the people have scattered. Jerusalem has been destroyed. The temple has been destroyed. The ark has been removed, never to return. And it's as if both the people of Israel are taken away into exile, and the presence of God is removed, so that Judah actually is empty. The area of Judah around Jerusalem is empty. There's nothing there. There are no people. They're not in the land. God is not with them. There's no blessing. So all the promises that were promised to Abraham seem not to be kept. And this is the kind of the tragedy or the irony of the Old Testament, is that during and around the exile, God sends prophets who elaborate on these promises, and they get bigger. The promises become even more spectacular. So that by the end of the Old Testament, we're looking forward not just to a restoration of this, but we're looking forward to a whole new creation. But the reality of the kingdom on the ground is not pretty. And the Old Testament ends with the ceasing of prophecy in about the year 400. And then there's just no word from God for about 400 years until Jesus comes on the scene. So that's the state of God's kingdom. The state of God's kingdom. It's not pretty. What we read is taking place right around this time. And if you would, open your Bibles for a moment, please, to Psalm 137. And Psalm 137 is the view of exile from below. From below. What we've done is we've sort of looked at the view of exile from above. We've taken a step back. We've looked at the very big picture. And Psalm 137 looks at the view from below, from the voice, from the vision of the Israelites who've been taken captive. And it begins in verse 1, "By the waters of Babylon, there we sat down and wept." So they've been taken captive into Babylon. And just to let you know quickly, down here at the bottom, I've drawn out for you in a very, it's a very loose way. You can look at this later if you can't quite see it. This is the kingdom of Israel having gained strength. The northern kingdom was taken captive by Assyria. These are all the superpowers of the ancient Near East. Babylon became very influential, and they were the ones that took the southern kingdom into exile. Persia became very strong. Alexander the Great and the Greek Empire grew in this period, and then, of course, the Roman Empire through to the time of Christ. So there's a gradual increase in superpowers around time. And here they are in Babylon, the capital of the Babylonian Empire, weeping over what has been lost. They're weeping over what has been lost. And I need to just mention to you that the last verse is quite shocking. If you didn't already notice that, Psalm 137, the last verse. Blessed shall he be who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rock. You have to understand the mindset of the Israelites, of the poets who wrote this. What they're saying is it's a kind of a Hebrew way of speaking. And the Hebrew way of speaking here is expressing their desire that God would give justice to them. So this isn't an explicit wish that they have. But what they're wishing for is that the ones who have taken them captive, that they themselves would be judged. And they're appealing to God for justice. But what's interesting is that through the exile, God takes justice on Israel. And there they are, by the waters of Babylon, weeping, aware of their need. People are in anguish because it appeared to them as if God's promises were being undone. Well, I want to draw for you now the third and final line on here. Third and final line. We've got the state of God's promises, the state of God's kingdom in the Old Testament, and now finally, the state of our hearts. Because you know, when you read the Old Testament, if all you see is the narrative of the rise and fall of the nation of Israel, you've missed the point. I mean, that's true, and it's history, and it's God working in history. But what's really going on in the Old Testament, I think, is that the state of our hearts after the fall is that we are rebellious towards God, we have a hard heart, we are stubborn, we think we know what is right and wrong, we follow our own way. And the state of the human heart in the Old Testament looks something like this. The state of the human heart is the same all the way through. So there has been an external and visible realization of the promises of God to some degree. It's imperfect. But the state of the human heart is rebellious all the way through the Old Testament until the time of Christ. And when Christ comes, the Davidic king, he will do something with the heart, which is the cause of sin in the first place. He will deal with the heart. And actually, just to give you a preview, what the New Testament says is that the human heart will be made righteous through Christ. Our heart will be made righteous before God in a way that it never could have been in the Old Testament. There were people in the Old Testament like David, like Abraham, many others, who had faith in God. And in the New Testament, it's the same thing that makes us righteous. It's faith in God that makes us righteous and gives us a new heart. So that's what's happening around these scriptures that we read this morning. Exile is the time where the physical and outward manifestation of the kingdom matches what's going on in the human heart. And it is a dark time. It is a dark time in the Old Testament. And it's important that we look at it, even if briefly this summer, so that we begin to understand why Christ's coming so important and so necessary, because there's a huge gap between the promises and the reality. And David didn't do it, and Solomon didn't do it, but Christ, the promised one, is the one that's going to make those promises come into effect. So let me finish by saying that I think the exile illustrates our need. The exile illustrates that the issue that we face is our sin and rebellion against God, and the inability of the Israelites to keep the Mosaic law means that they suffer consequences, and that they won't receive the blessings of God until the problem of the human heart is addressed and solved conclusively. The second thing that the exile teaches us is that God is merciful and patient. He will bring the consequences upon them, but he won't allow, he will bring those consequences down on his chosen one on our behalf. And when we come to our communion service this morning, if you want to take your bulletin, and I'm going to read with you on the top of page 6, how God can make this gap shrink. How does he make it shrink? How does he bring our hearts to the place where those promises can begin to be fulfilled? The top of page 6. This is what we say every time we have communion. Blessing and glory and thanksgiving. Now I want you to say this with me, please. Blessing and glory and thanksgiving be unto thee, Almighty God, our Heavenly Father, who of thy tender mercy didst give thine only Son, Jesus Christ, to take our nature upon him, and to suffer death upon the cross for our redemption, who made thereby his one oblation of himself once offered, a full, perfect, and sufficient sacrifice, oblation and satisfaction for the sins of the whole world, did institute and in his holy gospel command us to continue a perpetual memorial of that his precious death until his coming again. So when we take communion this morning, we remember that God has granted us his Son to accomplish for us what we could not accomplish through obeying him. Let us take a few minutes together now to pray, and Anne is going to.